10 years from today, Lisa Schneider will trade in her office job to become the leader of a pack of dogs. As the owner of her own dog rescue, that is. A second act made possible by the reskilling courses Lisa's taking now with AARP to help make sure her income lives as long as she does. And she can finally run with the big dogs and the small dogs who just think they're big dogs. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Learn more at aarp.org/skills.
There aren't many places where you can hear leading lights of astronomy like meteorite expert Monica Grady, Stephen Hawking collaborator John Ellis, and astronomer royal Martin Rees debating the cutting edge of space science today. But How the Light Gets In Festival is one of them. Coming to the gorgeous town of Hay-on-Wye from the 22nd to the 25th of May, the festival will gather the world's top scientists in astronomy and physics, alongside renowned philosophers, headline-making politicians, and beloved artists for 4 days of debates and talks. Early bird tickets are available for a short time at howthelightgetsin.org. Meanwhile, you can listen to a wealth of debates on everything from Martian exploration to the nitty-gritty of particle physics on How the Light Gets In official podcast, Philosophy for Our Times. It's available on Spotify, SoundCloud, Acast, and all good platforms. Or find out more at iai.tv.
Hello and welcome to Radio Astronomy, the podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine. You can subscribe to the print edition of the magazine by visiting skyatnightmagazine.com or to our digital edition by visiting iTunes or Google Play.
Greetings, listeners. It's time for the February episode of Radio Astronomy. I'm news editor Elizabeth Pearson, and I'm joined in the studio today by editor Chris Bramley.
Hello.
Production editor Neil McKim.
Hello.
And staff writer Ian Todd.
Hello.
Coming up later in this episode, we'll be talking to John Strachan, who was one of the organisers of a competition which sought to name over 100 exoplanets. And we'll be giving you our stargazing tip of the month. There's already been one major event in the astronomer's calendar that's happened this month, something that a lot of people look forward to, and that's the InSight Investment Astronomy Photographer of the Year Awards opening up. I know that we've really enjoyed, we always really enjoy taking part in this competition. It's good fun for us. We helped to actually take part in the judging panel as well. So yes, our art editor, Steve Marsh, is one of the judges who helps decide who's going to be the winner every year.
Yes, that's right. It's always a great day, isn't it, to go down there and have a look at the gallery, which for the first time this year was down in the actual National Maritime Museum at the bottom of the hill, rather than being in the smaller space in the Royal Observatory, which is the top of the hill. But they've done a great job with the gallery. It's a wonderful space, as well as the kind of backlit light box images of all the winning images. There's videos as well of that they've made with the photographers who won the competition. So it's a great thing to visit.
And if you want to stand your chance to be in that gallery in 2020, then pick up the February issue of BBC Sky at Night magazine, where we give you all of the details about how to enter. But for now, we're going to be looking at one of the other big space anniversaries we covered in this month's magazine. On the 18th of February, it will be 90 years since Clyde Tombaugh first discovered Pluto. So in this episode, we thought we'd take a deeper look into this not-quite-planet.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that really intrigues me about the discovery of Pluto is Clyde Tombaugh's story himself, because it's really a story of humble beginnings. Clyde Tombaugh was born in 1906 to this Illinois farming family, and they moved to Kansas, and basically 1 year a hailstorm ruined the family crops, so they couldn't afford to send young Clyde Tombaugh to university. But nevertheless, he got interested in looking up at the night sky, and age 20, he built his first telescope, started learning how to grind mirrors and build more telescopes. And his life really changed when he started sketching and observing Mars and Jupiter, because he sent his sketches to the Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff, Arizona, and was subsequently given a job as an assistant and groundskeeper in 1929. But while he was there, he became involved in the search for Planet X, which was this supposed planet beyond the orbit of Neptune. And it was really a means to describe irregularities in Uranus's orbit. There was this kind of theory that there must be this other planet causing these irregularities, predicted by Percival Lowell, among other astronomers, after whom the Lowell Observatory was named. But basically, yeah, there, Clyde Tombaugh started using this, started using the 13-inch astrograph that was at Lowell Observatory, and was taking images of the same section of sky over different nights, and using this machine called the Blink Comparator, where you get two images separated by a few seconds in time or a few minutes, and you're basically looking for an object that appears to be moving over the different plates. So you can kind of go between panel A and panel B, and you look at, because obviously the background stars remain the same, but any closer objects will appear to move. And yeah, he noticed an object that was moving, and they were able to use the, calculate the speed of it and work out that it was probably a trans-Neptunian object. Although they then subsequently worked out that it didn't have the mass to cause the necessarily, you know, calculations to explain Uranus's irregularity. So it was a bit of a coincidence. They were looking for something else, and instead they found Pluto. But yeah, it's still a pretty cool story.
If you if you look hard enough into the depths of space, you'll eventually find something.
Yeah.
So, I've used one of those blink comparator things before, and it's that sort of, you definitely get that little thrill when you sort of suddenly see something moving in the background, having, especially if you've been at it for hours trying to find one of these things. So I can't imagine what it must have been like to have found that finally.
I think the story is a great advert for the benefit of boredom, because it was repetitive work for that on the blink comparator, wasn't it? And also he was aiming the telescope and actually taking the pictures at the same time. So when he was taking the pictures, he had to keep it focused, and he had to keep one star in the field of view to keep it tracking right. So that was all boring work, but not as boring, not as mundane as the grounds work that he was doing. It was his day job. So, you know, he saw it as a welcome departure, his actual telescope work and the search for Pluto, and was all the more driven in his search.
Yeah, because apparently his work involved things like scraping the snow off the observatory domes and things like that.
Oh my God,
so he's probably like, can I come in out of the cold and look for a new planet?
Yeah. Hooray for automation and computer software. That's all I can say.
Yes, yeah, indeed, yeah.
After Clyde Tombaugh found Pluto, he kind of, I suppose that kind of propelled him into the astronomical limelight, so to speak, and he subsequently got a degree in astronomy from the University of Kansas and taught at the New Mexico State University, and then he kind of, I think he basically went back every now and then to Lowell and kind of kept looking and discovered asteroids and variable stars and things like that, you know, and he kind of realized his dream of being a professional astronomer. Passed away in January 1997. Mm-hmm. I guess his memory lives on. But one of the really interesting things about Pluto is the story of how it was named, because it's actually quite an unlikely source. Its name, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. I've been looking into that, and it was named by an 11-year-old girl from Oxford.
Obviously.
Unlikely naming.
And the story is, well, she was interviewed by NASA in 2006 when she was 87, just before the New Horizons launch, and her name was Venetia Burney, later Burney Fair, and she was asked why she chose the name. And she didn't quite know why, but she distinctly recalled the scene. And she was having breakfast with her grandfather, and he read the story out from the newspaper that they were looking for a name for this new planet that had been discovered. And she recalled saying, why not call it Pluto, after the god of the underworld? And her grandfather, he was Falconer Madden, a retired head librarian at Oxford's Bodleian Library, and he passed a note with her suggestion to Herbert Hall Turner, the director of Oxford University's observatory, who then cabled a telegram to the Lowell Observatory. So her suggestion got all the way over there, and they clearly thought it was a great idea. Mm-hmm. They named it after her suggestion. And it also, conveniently, the first two letters are also the initials of Percival Lowell, the founder of the Lowell Observatory.
Mm-hmm. It's good, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's just such a nice story. And I just love the idea of this little girl kind of sitting having breakfast and someone asks her to name a planet. And, you know, she comes up with, like, why not the god of the underworld?
Yeah. The mythological Roman god of the underworld, which I've been studying in my class recently.
And the fact that they were then able to get that, you know, information, you know, it's not like they could just kind of email NASA, you know, in those days, obviously, you know, they were able to get the information and...
It's the fact they had to telegram it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So cool.
Yeah. And of course, Pluto, the name has kind of gone on into popular culture, hasn't it? Helped a lot by Walt Disney, who was said to have been inspired by the planet's name when he introduced Mickey Mouse's canine companion in 1930, same year as it was discovered.
Yeah, yeah. Well, she was actually keen to point out that Disney's Pluto was named after the planet.
Yes, yeah.
It's a bit of a strange name for a dog if it wasn't for the planet.
Yeah.
I'm going to name my dog after the god of the underworld.
Yeah, that's right.
And for many years, the Pluto remained this remote object in the distant solar system that we could barely see. Point of light on a photographic frame. But that changed in 2015 when New Horizons flew past it. There's been plans to send a mission to Pluto for decades. Originally, the two Voyager probes were actually going to fly past Pluto, but they decided in the end that they would have to make too many compromises to make that work. So they just decided to stick to the four gas giants. But they carried on with this idea of sending a probe and launched New Horizons on the 19th of January 2006. It then took another 9 years to get to Pluto. And it came within 12,500 kilometres of the planet on the 14th of June 2015. I remember sitting in the office watching the pictures as they came in. It was that sort of Pluto's one of these worlds that kind of captured people's imagination a bit, possibly because it was the only world we hadn't seen, the only big body of the solar system that we hadn't seen up close. So when these pictures came in, it was kind of quite thrilling to see it.
It was that heart-shaped region. Just looks so cool.
Sputlik Planitia, that's called. And that was actually one of the strangest things about this planet, about this dwarf planet, I should say. Everybody was expecting it's this cold lump of ice on the outskirts of the solar system. Everybody was expecting it to be this like completely dead world. And it wasn't. That Sputnik Planitia, that white heart that you see on Pluto, is incredibly smooth. Mm. And that means that something is covering over the surface. It had a very young surface. Sputnik Planitia was actually also the largest known glacier in the solar system. It's about 1,000 kilometres across. And it was just people suddenly realised that even on the outskirts of our solar system, there's still a huge amount of activity going on. There's still things changing and evolving over time. The solar system certainly isn't dead anywhere you look. There was a couple of other interesting things they found. There's suggestions that Pluto could have a liquid ocean beneath its crust. So that was quite interesting. They also had a look, New Horizons took a look at Pluto's moons. They appear to have been created at the same time as Pluto. So whatever created Pluto also created its moons. But there was also something very strange they saw on Charon, which is sometimes pronounced Charon, sometimes pronounced Charon, which is the largest moon of Pluto, which is almost the same size as it. And that had a dark red cap, which they believe was something called tholins, which is an organic material. And they think actually what's happened is it's been stealing the atmosphere of Pluto and getting this sort of red substance all over its pole.
Yeah, because you also see that red substance on Pluto itself, don't you? Like the outline of the heart is red.
Yeah,
it's the same.
Yeah,
the same
they have. Well, they think it possibly is the same substance. It's also whilst that makes the surface red, it also makes Pluto's atmosphere slightly blue.
It's amazing that it has an atmosphere, you know. I mean,
yeah.
You know, so worlds like our moon don't have less of an atmosphere.
It's one of only four worlds which has a majority nitrogen atmosphere.
Yeah, there's a beautiful
Earth and Titan.
New Horizons image, and it shows Pluto's blue haze, and it's just a black circle, and the black circle is made by the outline of this gorgeous blue haze. It looks really, really amazing.
Yeah, it's a stunning pictures from Pluto, and I think that was one of the things that really struck me was just how beautiful this planet named after the god of the dead is.
Yes, that's right.
Didn't the New Horizons spacecraft carry Clyde Tombaugh's ashes on
it
board?
It did. It carried a very small vial of his ashes, which people thought, I certainly think, is a fitting tribute to the man. He never got to see the flyby by himself. He died, 10 years before it even launched, when it was still an idea on the drawing board. So the fact that he got to visit Pluto in some small way, I think, is quite charming.
Yeah, one of the tidbits I really like about New Horizons is that when it launched, Pluto was a planet, and when it arrived, Pluto was a dwarf planet. It's because that demotion had happened, during its journey.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. That demotion happened in 2006. But it was one chapter in a long story in the search and discovery and characterization of Pluto and really the region in the outer solar system, which kind of goes back to, well, if you trace it right back, it goes right back to the discovery of Uranus and Neptune, and the observation that these 19th century astronomers made that their orbits weren't quite right. There was a little bit of a discrepancy in the orbit. Planets were in slightly the wrong place according to where they should be, according to Newtonian dynamics and the gravitation of the planets. So it was Percival Lowell kind of took up this quest to discover what was causing this irregularity in the orbits of Uranus and Neptune. And he proposed Planet X at the end of the 19th century to explain the inconsistencies. And as you said earlier, Ian, he assumed that Planet X would be large and low density, like a giant planet like Saturn or Jupiter, and it'd have a similar brightness. So he was searching for a disk with a diameter of about one arc second and something that was bright enough to be spotted. And so, when Clyde Tombaugh found Pluto in 1930, straight away they said, "Oh, we found Planet X." But astronomers were never really sure that Pluto was Planet X. And actually, just a couple of months after the discovery, some astronomers were writing in newspapers, in the New York Times. They ran a story that Pluto couldn't be a planet. It was more like an asteroid, and the orbit like an asteroid, because they could characterize its orbit even in 1930. And they thought it was more like an asteroid than a comet. And then in the decades following the discovery in 1930, people were able to kind of define some characteristics of Pluto a little bit more clearly. So its mass, the mass estimates kept coming down for Pluto. Initially, when it was discovered, they thought its mass was would be roughly Earth-like. Then it was revised down to the mass of Mars in 1948. And then it had its albedo, or its reflectivity, calculated for the first time. And when they did that, they found that it matched... it had a similar brightness to methane ice, meaning that Pluto had to be exceptionally luminous for its size, and so it couldn't be more than 1% of the mass of Earth. So it went right down the mass then. And then when Pluto's moon, I'm going to call it Charon, when Charon was discovered in 1978, it was finally possible to measure the actual mass of Pluto. And when they did that, they found it to be roughly 0.2% of Earth's mass, and at that point, they knew it was far too tiny to affect the orbit of Uranus. And so that didn't stop the search for Planet X. But these days, most astronomers agree that Planet X, as kind of Percival Lowell proposed, doesn't really exist. Mm. And then following on from the 1978, when they were actually able to measure the mass, Pluto's status got called more and more into question when astronomers discovered several objects of a similar size further out in the Kuiper Belt. And in 2005, astronomers discovered Eris, a dwarf planet in the outer Kuiper Belt, which is 27% more massive than Pluto. And that was kind of the death knell for Pluto as a planet. And on the back of this, the International Astronomy Union set up a working group to actually define the term planet, which had never been done before. And they came up with a definition, formally adopted it in 2006. And one of the outcomes of that was Pluto was excluded from the planetary status and reclassified as a dwarf planet. But that's not to say there aren't other objects out in the far reaches of the Kuiper Belt. Even though Planet X is no more, many more actual dwarf planets have been discovered. Albion, Sedna, Quaoar, Haumea, and my personal favourite, Mackie Mackie.
Some fantastic names.
Yeah. I think, isn't Haumea the spinning rugby ball?
Yes, that's right.
It's like a 4-hour day or something.
Yeah,
like
it's a really odd shape. Yeah. And there's also been a revival of the hypothetical planet in the outer solar system in Planet Nine. This has been inferred from gravitational effects, and it could help explain the clustering of groups of bodies beyond Neptune. They reckon Planet Nine could be about 5 to 10 times the mass of Earth, so a kind of super Earth type planet, and in an orbit 400 to 800 times the Earth Sun distance, so a whopping distance away.
Yeah, you think that it's the solar system, we should know it really well, and then. Because I think I forget how far away these things are. I think it's like billions and billions of kilometres away.
Yeah,
and you're looking for one tiny point of light that you need a really powerful telescope to pick up in the entire vastness of space, and you need to see it moving. It's a miracle we find anything out
there. The chances are just minuscule, aren't they, when you're searching for that area of sky.
Unless you know where you're looking.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's kind of mostly chance.
Yeah.
I mean, the Pluto planet debate's really interesting itself. Wasn't the one definition that it didn't meet up to, wasn't it, that Pluto doesn't clear its own orbit?
Yes, there's three criteria, I believe. It has to go around the sun rather than going around something that goes around the sun. It has to be large enough to pull itself into a sphere.
Check.
Which is about 1,000 kilometres wide. That starts happening. Mm. And it needs to be big enough to clear its own orbit of debris.
Yeah.
Mm. And that's one that is a lot. Some people still find a bit controversial because technically Jupiter hasn't cleared its orbit. Mm. There's the Trojan asteroids caught in its gravitational well. Mm. And so it's kind of one of those big questions of what does that actually... So they've made this definition, but still people don't agree with it. And I'm sure there'll be arguments about it for decades to come.
Yeah.
Well, the jury's still out on Planet Nine, but we have found thousands of planets around other stars. And at the end of last year, the International Astronomical Union held an international competition for members of the public across the globe to name more than 100 alien worlds. Now, I spoke to John Strachan, part of the international organising group for the competition, and I started off by asking him what the IAU's Name Exoworlds campaign was all about.
So basically, the International Astronomy Union decided to run this Name Exoworlds campaign, partly because, I don't know if you knew, it was 100 years since we were set up last year. So it was our 100th birthday. It was part of 100-year birthday celebrations. And it was for a good idea to promote astronomy throughout the different countries of the world and to give people in those countries the opportunity to promote it themselves. So the astronomy societies or the schools or colleges that would get involved, they would be able to take part in the campaign and we'll be able to promote astronomy. Because obviously the International Astronomy Union, its main goals are the safeguard and the promotion of astronomy throughout the world and throughout all the countries. And we wanted to be as inclusive as possible, to include as many countries as we possibly could in this campaign. And we managed to get over 100 countries in the end to give us names, which was a big success. It was truly international campaign. And from the IAU, it was pretty international. The project manager, Eduardo Penteado, he was Brazilian. And then we had on the steering committee, we had good people from Spain, from America, from France, and Japan, and different countries throughout the world on the steering committee.
The UK was one of the countries that that named one of these AXO worlds. What was the name chosen from the UK?
Okay, so the one of the things that was important and what we stressed, it wasn't a rule, but what we stressed, what we want to have and culturally want to have, is that the countries would be able to name things after indigenous names for the countries. It was United Nations Indigenous Languages Year last year as well, which dovetailed into that quite nicely. So I'm quite happy that the winning names for the United Kingdom were chosen from the Manx Gaelic language, and they were chosen. Another thing that was important was to get young people involved in the proposals, and for the United Kingdom, that was a primary school was involved, Conkey Berry, who proposed the names, and the names were Glowis, which means shine, and for the star, and Cunlac, which means orbit for the exoplanet. So those were the names, and there's a nice link there between the star shines and the exoplanet. Cunlac orbits around the star.
So that's a nice link, isn't it? Yeah,
that was a nice link. So as that was another important thing, as well as the name of the star and the planet, we wanted a theme so that we describe. I could describe it like this, or there are lots of other things to describe, and it would give us the opportunity to be able, if more exoplanets were found around the system, then we could name the new exoplanets based on these themes.
Oh, I see. Yes, so it can be continued on, and it could have that theme can kind of carry on throughout.
So research.
Yeah.
So this was for WASP-13, was the actual system that we named the star and the planet. And for each country, the star and planet was assigned was a star that was visible in that country with a small telescope.
Oh, that's nice.
So you can look at WASP-13, you can look at the star, you can see it with a small telescope, an amateur can with a small telescope and see it in the night sky.
Oh, that's pretty good. Quite a few proposals came in from the UK, didn't they?
I think there were thousands of original proposals, and they were whittled down by the UK National Committee down to 10. And one of them was the types of stones in Stonehenge, so the blue stones and the Saracen stones were some of the names. And there were plenty of others. Some were named after mountains. I think one was Snowdon. So there were lots of different sets of names. And that's what you find. And as well, when people go and decide names and themes, they come up with all wonderful and very varied themes that you probably wouldn't think of yourself to name and planets after, but which have cultural and national significance for that country.
How is this different to the way exoplanets are usually named?
Right, so exoplanets are usually named, basically we take the name of a star, and then the star is sort of, I give an example, HD189733 is a name of a star, not very interesting, but it's a name, it's from a Henry Draper catalog, and then you put an A after it, and that would stand for the star, and then the first exoplanet detected around it would have a B, a lowercase b, and then next one would be C, D, E, F, and that's how they would be named. So a lot of these names aren't particularly memorable, as you can imagine, which is a very efficient way of naming them, because then you can name all the planets very quickly. But a lot of them aren't that memorable. So what's happened? So if we have the opportunity to give them, proper names after things, then they'll be more memorable, and the amateur astronomy community can use them, and professional astronomy astronomers will use them as will be able to use them as well and refer to them.
So that's it. That's part of your research. Is it your kind of day job, as it were? Is you're involved in exoplanet discoveries?
I work on research in searching for exoplanets and the characterization of them. Mainly using a high-resolution spectroscopy and the radio velocity method, and detect them, and then analyze the data and help to detect them and to carry. And I've written a number of algorithms to help characterize the planets.
Right, in terms of atmosphere, or in terms of the density and what their material they're made of, that kind of thing.
Well, that's right. Getting towards that area, I've written algorithms which allow you when the planet transit in front of a star, which you're familiar with, you see the light curve, which is from photometry. You can look at that through spectroscopy, and when the planet passes in front of a star, it causes a distortion in the spectral lines, and I'm able to track that distortion as it goes across the star, and determine whether the orbits aligned with the star or not, based on the spin of the star. And I'm also working on algorithms to do with the noise on stars, because one of the biggest problems we have with detecting planets is with radio velocity method is that some of the stars are quite noisy, and at the moment algorithms to track star spots as they go across the stars, and this causes a radial velocity shift in the signal, and try to remove that signal so I can remove any of these signals from these star spots, which could potentially be mistaken for our planets.
Oh, I see. So when you say noise, that's the kind of, you know, you're talking noise in kind of radio. When you're listening to the radio, it's kind of that, you know, interference, and it's kind of that, all that fuzzy stuff. But when you're looking for exoplanets, noise is star spots.
Or activity. You could have noise as in white noise, which is what you hear, which is the random fuzz. But noise could be structured as well. So it could have a structure like a periodic signal, but it could correspond to some activity on the star. It could be pulsating or a spot grinder or something, which will cause a signal which may imitate what the velocity signature from a planet is. So noise is anything that's not a planet signal, so far as I'm concerned. However, some people's noise is other people's information. So other people are interested in studying the activity of stars and are really interested in these signals. So, and that is their signal. So it depends on how you're looking at the system and what you want to get from it.
Yeah. So the algorithms you've developed help to isolate passages of actual exoplanets. Is research at a stage yet where we can determine conditions on these exoplanets, or is it still at the stage where we're actually kind of filtering out the noise and finding these worlds?
Yeah, I mean, but we're still at the early stages. We are able. It depends on the. If the planet transits and it's got a strong enough signal that you can actually detect a Doppler shift, then you can work out the full mass of the planet from the secondary transit. Because as the planet goes behind the star, you get a signal. So you get this a second dip, and from that you can get an estimate of what the temperature of the planet, profile of the planet is, and. From transit spectroscopy, which is during the transit, you can detect some of the molecules in the atmosphere of the star. But we're at the early stages, really. We're not at the stage yet where we can say what these planets actually look like from our data. You know, actually look like, you know, all the pictures you see of exoplanets on the TV, on the magazines, and that are all manufactured and made up. But artist impressions, but I'm sure eventually we'll get there.
The first exoplanet was found around 30 years ago, and since then over 4,000 have been discovered. And that number continues to double roughly every 2.5 years. Do you think we'll get to a point where we won't be able to carry on giving proper names to these planets?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's we were only naming planets around fairly bright stars here, so we're the number of stars we're looking at. But you're right. There's probably planets around most stars, a lot of stars anyway. So I mean, we'll end up finding millions of these, or even eventually billions of these planets, you know, as time goes on. So we're not going to be able to give, well, probably names to them all. Well, we're going to have to give designations and numbers to them, but I don't know. The thing is, as planets and that become my view is as systems have become interesting to us, a lot of work goes on to them, and maybe we'd want to give them names then. You know, these systems name exoplanets are close to us, so they're interesting, they're bright from bright stars. So the stars are already quite bright, and that's why it's useful to give them names. And as time goes on, we'll give them. A few of them, I'm sure, will be giving names to things. I mean, you know, United Kingdom, we have lots of streets. We give them all names. I'm just sure that could probably end up being the sort of thing we do if astronomers want to do that and people want to do that. It become more and more interesting as we find out more and more about the planets and what they're like. Then at the moment, a lot of the names are. We're naming them after places, you know, or something about the Earth. But in the future, we might name them about some characteristics that these planets actually have, you know, that are pretty unique to them or we haven't seen before. We'll name them after that whatever they may be. So the actual naming process may change over time as well, I see.
Sure. Great. John, thank you very much for talking to us.
No problem.
That was John Strachan. There are a load of great names on that list, so we thought we would take a minute to go over some of our favourites.
Well, I was interested in seeing what Ireland came up with, and they were tasked with naming the yellow dwarf star HATP36 and the exoplanet that orbits around that. The stars found in the constellation Canis Venatici. And the star name that they gave was Turin, and the exoplanet was Bran. And these come from... Irish mythology, basically. Turin was the aunt of the Irish warrior Finn McCool, kind of probably the most famous of the kind of big Celtic warriors in Irish mythology. Turin was turned into a hound by a fairy who was jealous because Turin had married her former lover. And while she was a hound, she gave birth to two of her sons, Bran and Sciulain. So they were kind of dogs born as a result of that. So... The star was named Turin and the exoplanet was named Bran as a result.
And Poland caught my attention. They've gone for the orange dwarf star, BD plus 14-4559, in the constellation of Monoceros with its exoplanet. The names are characters associated with the Polish science fiction writer Stanisław Lem, who's a national hero of Poland. While the star is called Perks, a fictional character from his Tales of Perks the Pilot, the exoplanet is fittingly called Solaris, named after the writer's famous 1961 novel about an ocean-covered exoplanet.
Mm-hmm. And I went looking for one that I thought had a particularly nice story, and I came across exoplanets named by Chile. So they had... HD164604. You can see why they needed new names, these stars, which is a dwarf star in Sagittarius. And theirs were all named after mythology to do with the sea around the southern islands of Chiloé. So the star is named Pincoya, who is a female water spirit in the southern oceans. And she collects up the drowned sailors and brings them to Caluche, which was the name of the planet. And Caluche is a large ghost ship which sails across the sea, and it's where these drowned sailors can go and live the rest of their afterlife.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Very nice. Lovely story.
And a lot of African countries also got in on the campaign. Nigeria's selection caught my eye. Nigeria's selection was the planet HD 43197b, around a yellow dwarf star in the constellation of Canis Major. And the star name chosen was Amadioha, and the planet name is Equiano. And these are historical or mythological figures of Nigeria who stand for justice and human dignity. Amadioha is the god of thunder in the mythology of the Igbo people of southeastern Nigeria, and Equiano was an 18th century Nigerian writer and abolitionist who fought to eliminate the slave trade.
Mm. So those are just a few examples and our favourites, but you can look at all 112 names for yourself at nameexoworlds.iau.org. Now it's time for our stargazing tip of the month. During the first half of February, you should be able to spot the nearest planet to the sun, Mercury, in the evening sky. To see the planet, you'll want a flat vantage point with a clear view to the west-southwest horizon. Once you're sure the sun has gone down, as you don't want to damage your eyes, look for the bright planet Venus towards the southwest horizon. It should be fairly easy to spot. If you look below this, closer to the horizon, you should see another point of light. That's Mercury. The planet is best seen in the first 10 days of the month. Though the planet will appear higher in the sky in later days, the planet's waning, which means it will appear dimmer in the night sky. So that's it from us this month. You can find out more about the discovery of Pluto in the February issue of BBC Sky at Night magazine, where we also take an in-depth look at everything you need to know to get started in astronomy, tell you all the details of the Insight Investment Astronomy Photographer of the Year Awards 2020, and delve into the science hidden inside the changing shape of the aurora. That's not forgetting our regular sections that will help you unlock the wonder of the night sky, find the right equipment to observe it with, and discover the best things to see after dark this month. If you have any or questions or comments for us here at Radio Astronomy, they can always contact us on Twitter at Sky at Night Mag, on Facebook, or via email at contactus@skyatnightmagazine.com. From all of us here at BBC Sky at Night Magazine, goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Radio Astronomy Podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine, which was produced in our Bristol studio by Jack Bateman and Ben Hewitt. For more of our podcasts, visit our website at skyatnightmagazine.com or head to iTunes, Acast or Spotify.